This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, verses number 29 and 30, recited by Saeed Maliki.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Qul in ما في صدوركم أو تبدوه يعلمه الله ويعلم ما في السماوات وما في الأرض وَاللَّهُ عَلَى كُلِّ شَيْءٍ قَدِيرٌ يَوْمَ تَجِدُ كُلُّ نَفْسٍ مَا عَمِلَتْ مِنْ خَيْرٍ مُحْضَرًا وما عملت من سوء تود لو أن بينها وبينه أمدا بعيدا ويحذركم الله نفسه والله رؤوف بالعباد صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the merciful. Say, whether you hide what is in your heart or manifest it, Allah knows it, and He knows whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth, and Allah has power over all things. On the day that every soul shall find present what it has done of good and what it has done of evil, it shall wish that between it and that evil there were a long duration of time. And Allah makes you to be cautious of retribution from Himself, and Allah is compassionate to the servants.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Several rockets hit Kandahar Airport in southern Afghanistan. Taliban militants have claimed responsibility for the attack. A coronavirus-related ban on evictions in the U.S. expires, putting millions of people at risk of becoming homeless. The number of COVID cases in Japan keeps rising, despite a state of emergency imposed in many parts of the country. Hello everyone, welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Badr Zanjafir. Good to have you with us. Now, starting with Afghanistan this hour, three rockets have hit the Kandahar airport as the Taliban pressing ahead with their offensive across the country. The chief of Kandahar airport said that the attack happened overnight with at least two rockets hitting the runway. The official added that all flights were canceled. Work is underway to repair the runway. The Taliban have claimed responsibility. The militants have recently launched sweeping attacks on the outskirts of Kandahar, raising fears they are on the verge of capturing the provincial capital. Fierce clashes are also underway in several cities and provinces as the group is inching closer to take provincial capitals, including Herat in the west and Lashkargah in the south. Millions of Americans are at risk of eviction from their homes after a ban on booting out indebted renters expired Saturday night. The U.S. Supreme Court allowed the 11-month moratorium to stay in place last month, but ruled that any further extension would require congressional approval. Republicans in the House of Representatives, however, blocked Democratic-led efforts to extend the eviction ban through mid-October. The legislation is now adjourned for 6 week summer recess of the House. The delay drew criticism from Democrat representatives. Elizabeth Warren said that many families are facing a devastating, disruptive, and unnecessary eviction. Missouri Representative Cori Bush also spent Friday night outside of U.S. Capitol in an act of protest.
This is a systemic problem. This is a structural problem that can be handled by better policy decisions. So that's why we're out here. That's why all of these people showed up. There was more people out here last night.
Bush also lashed out at her Democratic colleagues for going on vacation early rather than staying to vote for the legislation. Some 15 million Americans are behind on the rents amid COVID-19 restrictions. The pandemic has infected nearly 35 million people in the U.S. and killed 613,000 others. Correspondent Wyatt Reed says many Americans are wondering why they should be forced out of their homes in a country that's set to be a wealthy and prosperous.
A lot of folks really wondering, you know, we supposedly live in the wealthiest, most prosperous nation on the planet, and I think this is coming really from left and from right. You know, how is it that for all of these supposed wondrous standards of living increases that we've achieved, we can't manage to continue not only the rent assistance, you know, which has really been extremely slow to come out, now being directed on a state-by-state basis. And of course, you can't discard the fact that certain states, right-wing, there are certain political considerations that are probably playing into this in terms of the dispersion of supplies. But a lot of people wondering on both sides of the aisle, you know, how can this really happen, not just for renters, but for homeowners as well, for the landlords as well, their assistance, and homeowners who are about to be foreclosed on, that assistance has not been forthcoming either at a national or a state-based level, of course. So all of these questions really linger in the air, and they all point not just to one party or the other, you know, the traditional big bad Republicans that are consistently stomping out any attempts, and the Democrats who, for all their supposed efforts, can't manage to get sort of the bare minimum accomplished.
Japan has reported 12,000 new daily COVID-19 cases. The third day in a row, the country's infections topped 10,000 amid Tokyo Olympics. The new infections bring total caseload to more than 926,000. Japan also reported 9 new deaths, pushing the tally to 15,200. The spike in infections had prompted the government to announce a state of emergency in Tokyo and 5 other regions. Authorities blamed the surge on the highly transmissible Delta strain, denying any link with the Olympics. The organizing committee at the Games says that only 241 people involved in the Olympics have got COVID infections, 23 of them being athletes. Indonesia officials saying that 1,800 COVID patients lost their lives in the past day, the world's highest death toll on Saturday. The country has become the new COVID-19 epicenter in Asia, with record infections and deaths this month. Officials blame the surge on the Delta variant that's more contagious and deadlier than its original virus. Vietnam is also facing a rise in infections with a total of 145,000 cases. The government has extended the strict lockdown measures in Ho Chi Minh, as well as in other 18 cities and provinces, for 2 more weeks to help combat its worst COVID outbreak. Infectious diseases specialist Gloria Italiani says vaccination should be the main tool to prevent the development of new coronavirus variants.
Lockdown is the measure we have used when we didn't have any other opportunity and any other tool to contrast the circulation of the virus. It seems to be a little bit outdated because now we have the vaccine, and vaccination should be the main target and the main tool to constrain the virus. It sounds really strange to use lockdown in a period when we could use properly and efficiently the vaccine as a containment measure to reduce not only the circulation, which is also a target of vaccination, but mostly the development of severe disease and the occurrence of death. When we didn't have any other way of contrasting the spread of the virus, at that time, of course, lockdown was the only useful measure. But at the moment, we should
Hundreds of Italian demonstrators have taken to the streets to protest the new coronavirus restrictions in their country. Protesters marched through the streets of Milan to voice anger against the Green Pass, the vaccine passport, to chant slogans against Prime Minister Mario Draghi. The so-called Green Pass is a digital or paper certificate that shows if someone has received at least one jab, has tested negative for, or has recently recovered from COVID-19. In July, the government issued a new decree requiring a pass for access to more leisure and cultural venues, including indoor restaurants. Now, French police have clashed with people protesting the COVID health pass and compulsory vaccination. My colleague has discussed that issue in our news review program with our guests. Let's see what our guests have to say.
And now it's time for this hour's news review. French police have clashed with ralliers protesting the COVID health pass and compulsory vaccination. Police used tear gas and water cannons to disperse protesters in Paris. Some 3,000 officers were deployed to the capital for the third weekend of protests. Now, similar demonstrations were held in several other cities across the country. The new COVID health pass came into effect in France amid a surge of new infections. People need proof of vaccination, a negative test, or recent recovery from COVID to enter most museums and cinemas. Lawmakers have also approved to extend its use for entry to cafes, restaurants, and some shopping malls. COVID-19 in France has infected more than 6 million people and claimed the lives of nearly 112,000 others. Let me welcome my guests to this news review, Chris DeHand in Paris and John Stepling, author and commentary out of Norway. Thank you both for being with us. Chris, I'm going to start off with you and tell us what was going on and just your overall feel for things while you were out there on the streets today in Paris.
Well, I participated in the main march today. There were different marches. The main march was organized by the Yellow Vest Movement, and I think we can say today that there is a kind of rebirth of the Yellow Vest Movement after different lockdowns, because in this beginning day of the holiday season, thousands took the street in one main demand. They are against the health pass. They are not, most people I spoke to are not against the vaccination itself. They are against the mandatory health pass, which is an electronic document that people have to show when they want to enter in public places. So that's the main common demand. Now, to contradict the protesters, in most hospitals, doctors, they say that people who enter today in the hospitals with severe COVID symptoms, they are all non-vaccinated people. So this is a very clear indication that people should be vaccinated in order not to transmit the COVID virus and in order not to get the COVID virus themselves. So it means also that people, I think they are not stupid. They are aware that the vaccination itself can be really efficient. So that's why they are not so much against the vaccination, but they are more against the health pass, against what they consider as, again, authoritarian measure of the French government and a kind of violation of individual liberty.
All right, so stay with me, Chris. I'm going to come back to you because John is definitely just shaking his head to just about everything you have to say. John, tell me what's going on, your perspective.
Look, the protests are are not anti-vaxxers. They're not right-wing protests. These protests are working-class people. In fact, there have been suggestions from firefighters and different unions to even strike in protest to the vaccine passport. You are creating a two-tier society. And the entire COVID narrative from the beginning has to be examined a little critically here. We're talking about a pandemic with a fatality rate of under 1%. 100,000 people died in France. It's a country of 67 million. You can do the math. The life expectancy globally has not been affected by this pandemic. It is so mild. In 1918, the Spanish flu lowered U.S. life expectancy 27% as a comparison. This has been pushed. The vaccine passports have been pushed against all reason, against all logic. Dissenting opinions have been squashed. Censorship has been increased. people are being deplatformed, doctors, associations of medical professionals, deplatformed, censored because they dissent against the master narrative, as it were, which is being pushed by the big pharma, the United States, the WHO, and private individuals, those sort of unelected billionaires that seem to have extraordinary influence these days.
Well, Chris, tell me, you were on the streets. I mean, when you were talking to people, you just heard what John was saying. And you also mentioned authoritarian type measures. I mean, was overall this the problem for most of the people? It's the weeding of rights? Or tell me their main complaint about what's going on and why they were on the streets.
The main complaint is the mandatory health pass. And also the push for people to get vaccinated. That's the main complaint. But this is contradicted by medical personnel. I mean, if you see in the UK, in Denmark, or in the Netherlands, that most of the people are vaccinated, and that the coronavirus health pass in Denmark is almost abolished in September, because the more people are vaccinated, the less even the Delta variant has impact on the people's health. In the opposite way, in Martinique, La Réunion, and Saint-Martin, overseas French colonies, if you want, or territories, there is a new lockdown because very few people are vaccinated, and there is a new wave of coronavirus, people affected. And people are dying if they are seriously affected. I mean, if you are vaccinated, you are not dying. If you are not vaccinated, many people die. This is not just propaganda from a government. These are medical facts.
Chris, of course, people are dying. But what about what John has said about less than 1% of the people getting it, they're dying? Less than 1%, that's... It's of course very controversial, even talking about it. But in some ways, quite mind-boggling that we're talking about less than 1% of the people who are getting or dying it globally.
That's a lot of people. I mean, if the hospitals are totally in panic because they are receiving tens of thousands of people a day. And if you have 300, 400, or even 500 death casualties a day, that's right. Very different than the actual situation where you have less than 20 people who die every day. So that the impact on society is totally different.
Okay.
So that's medical facts, yes.
Well, thanks so much. And thus we see the controversy just when we have our two guests right here for the News Review. And perhaps we can understand a little bit more why people on the streets and disagreeing with so many things. So thank you guys both for being with me here on this News Review. Chris DeHond up there in Paris, and John Stefling, author and commentator out of Endre, Norway.
I'm moving on. Hundreds have rallied in Tel Aviv to protest Israel's new COVID restrictions. Protesters played down the COVID-19 outbreak and denounced vaccinations, and that's why Israel reported some 2,400 cases on Saturday, its highest tally since March. The fastest-spreading Delta strain has been blamed for the uptick in infections. Israel has reimposed the mask requirements indoors, ruled out a booster vaccine shot for the elderly, and restored vaccine certificate requirements for entering enclosed public spaces. The Turkish president has vowed to punish perpetrators if it turns out that wildfires on the country's southern coast were sparked by arson.
If you rip our heart out, I swear we will rip your heart out. If we find such a connection, which there are already some indications, we will do whatever it takes.
A Turkish official said the cause of the fires is under investigation, and Saturday the death toll rose to 6, including 2 firefighters. Some 200 people have also been injured, and hundreds of homes charred to the ground. 100 fires have broken out across Turkey since Wednesday. One of the hardest hit areas has been the resort city of Antalya. Temperatures have soared in the region over the past days, with high winds fanning the flames. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye. Thank you.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
In the limelight.
An internal slide presentation assembled by officials at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention warns that the Delta variant of the coronavirus, now dominant strain in the U.S. and across much of the world, is as transmissible as chickenpox, could lead to more extreme illness than earlier mutations, and can likely be spread by people who are fully vaccinated. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jake Johnson, writer.
This article is published under the heading, A Very Serious Threat. CDC document warns Delta variant is as contagious as chickenpox. Stay tuned for more. An internal slide presentation assembled by officials at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention warns that the Delta variant of the coronavirus, now the dominant strain in the U.S. and across much of the world, is as transmissible as chickenpox, could lead to more extreme illness than earlier mutations, and can likely be spread by people who are fully vaccinated. First obtained by the Washington Post recently, the document states that the Delta variant may cause more severe disease than Alpha or ancestral strains, citing data on hospitalizations and deaths in Canada, Scotland, and Singapore, while noting that people who are fully inoculated against COVID-19 can still catch and spread the Delta variant. The document stresses that vaccines are extremely effective in preventing severe illness and death. Delta is different from previous strains. One of the slides reads, summarizing that the variant is highly contagious, likely more severe, and breakthrough infections may be as transmissible as unvaccinated cases. The presentation says Delta is more contagious than Ebola, the seasonal flu, the flu of 1918, and smallpox. Dr. Rachel Walensky, the director of the CDC, confirmed the authenticity of the leaked document in an interview with CNN. I think people need to understand that we are not crying wolf here. This is serious, Walensky said, adding, it's one of the most transmissible viruses we know about. Chickenpox, this, they're all up there. An unnamed federal official told the New York Times that the CDC is expected to publish additional data on the Delta variant. The CDC is very concerned with the data coming in that Delta is a very serious threat that requires action now, the official said. Some public health experts who reviewed the CDC document said they are now even more worried about the Delta variant, which was first detected in India in December and has since spread to more than 100 countries. The U.S. is currently averaging around 71,000 new coronavirus cases a day, with more than 80% of those attributable to the Delta strain. I finished reading it significantly more concerned than when I began, Robert Watcher, chairman of the Department of Medicine at the University of California at San Francisco, told the Post. But Dr. Ashish Jha, dean of the Brown University School of Public Health, said that while the document makes clear the Delta variant is a major issue, he found the presentation to be largely reassuring. Bottom line, yeah, Delta variant is bad, like really bad, Jha wrote in a series of tweets recently, but he added, our vaccines are good, like really good, breakthrough infections happen, sometimes they may spread to others, but if enough people get a shot, the pandemic does come to an end. In addition to full vaccination, the CDC document recommends universal masking as a way to control the spread of the Delta variant. That advice is significantly more sweeping than the guidance the CDC released to the public earlier this week, which recommended that vaccinated people wear masks in public indoor spaces only in areas of the country where cases are surging. The agency's presentation surfaced as the administration announced recently that federal civilian employees who do not show proof of vaccination will be required to wear a mask, undergo coronavirus testing once or twice per week, and socially distance. Biden said in a speech recently, last month, a study showed that over 99% of COVID-19 deaths had been among the unvaccinated. People are dying and will die who don't have to die. If you're out there unvaccinated, you don't have to die.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
The British government has proposed reforms to the Official Secrets Act that could potentially see journalists and whistleblowers punished with much harsher sentencing for publishing things that the government doesn't like. Now, this comes as the United Kingdom has granted the United States limited permission to appeal a judge's decision in January not to extradite Julian Assange. A key witness for the U.S. prosecution recently admitted to fabricating their testimony against Assange. So why is the U.K. allowing the proceedings to go ahead anyway and clamping down on the rights of journalists? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. The case against Julian Assange is not just an attack on journalism. It's a case that is filled with anomalies, illegalities, and government wrongdoing and foul play. Julian Assange's extradition hearing took place almost a year ago in September 2020 in London, dubbed the Trial of the Century. I was there as it unfolded, and we covered it extensively on this program. Now, in January earlier this year, the judge overseeing the case, Judge Baretzer, decided not to extradite Julian Assange to the United States. The incoming Biden administration made it clear that it would be appealing this decision and moving forward with the Trump administration's plan to jail the Australian journalist and founder of WikiLeaks. Now, 6 months later, in July of 2021, a British High Court gave the United States permission to appeal that decision. The United States attempted to appeal on five grounds, however, only three were granted by the High Court. Now, the grounds of appeal deal almost exclusively with Julian Assange's health and the potential risk of suicide were he to be sent to the United States. During both pre-trial and post-trial, Assange would most certainly be placed in solitary confinement in a U.S. federal super maximum prison, such as ADX Florence in Colorado. Judge Peretzer ruled that an extradition to the United States would pose such a significant risk to Assange's health that she blocked it on those grounds. However, she did agree with all of the other arguments put forward by the U.S. prosecution, namely the political charges such as espionage and conspiracy to commit computer intrusion. If convicted, Assange could face up to 175 years in prison. Such a ruling is dangerous because it effectively criminalizes journalism and national security reporting. It's saying that if you publish damning evidence of U.S. war crimes in Iraq, in Afghanistan, Guantanamo Bay, and diplomatic cables, you will be sent to jail for informing the public. Now, this means that an appeal in the UK High Court will only discuss Julian Assange's health and the prospects of his extradition and nothing else, because the judge has already accepted that his publishing, his work, his journalism amount to criminal behavior. Needless to say, this is a disaster for journalists everywhere and highlights just how problematic this entire case is. Now, the defense does have an opportunity to cross-appeal the decision, which would allow them to dispute the judge's agreement with the political charges. However, this is uncertain yet, as no announcement on that move has been made thus far. Now, just as the United States was granted this limited permission to appeal, it turns out the United States also made an offer to the UK that it could let Julian Assange potentially serve his sentence in his home country of Australia. The US also provided assurances that it would not place Julian Assange under special administrative measures, also known as SAMs. SAMs are a very strict regime where prisoners are kept in solitary confinement up to 23 hours a day. All of their incoming and outgoing mail is screened. They are only allowed one telephone call a month for 30 minutes, only to a pre-approved person. And this call, they must request this call in advance so that a government agent can be made available to spy on the conversation. The prisoners' conversations with their lawyers are also monitored. As a matter of fact, the lawyers themselves are placed under a gag order, preventing them from telling the outside world about their clients' conditions and what's happening inside of the jail. These horrific conditions are very likely what Assange would be placed under were he to be extradited to the United States. Everyone understands this, including the judge. Now, in court, the United States lawyers repeatedly argued that SAMs were not that bad, right? They made an attempt to portray these inhumane prison conditions in the United States as acceptable or humane. The prosecution even argued that there was an appeal process for prisoners to progressively lift these restrictions on themselves, even though not a single prisoner has ever succeeded in doing so. Now, Gary McKinnon, who's a Scottish systems administrator, he's said to have perpetrated the biggest computer hack of all time. In 2002, he accessed computers belonging to the U.S. Air Force, Navy, the Department of Defense, NASA, and much more. The U.S. also tried to extradite him to face jail time, but ultimately failed after a lengthy and grueling legal battle that lasted a decade. I spoke with Gary not too long ago, and I asked him about the so-called assurances that he was given by the United States at the time. And unsurprisingly, he told me that they're worthless, just like the ones that have been made to Assange now. Now, reacting to these so-called assurances, Assange's partner and fiancée Stella Morris said, quote, "They aren't worth the paper they're written on." She was quick to remind people that these assurances emanate from the same U.S. figures and organizations who spied on Assange and tried to steal their son's diaper from the Ecuadorian embassy for DNA analysis. Morris also lambasted the media for reporting inaccurately on these assurances, right, as if they were set in stone and 100% guaranteed, when in fact there is a very important distinction to be made. The United States did not say that it won't place Assange under SAMs. It said that it might not place Assange under SAMs, and that is not the same thing. Right? In their so-called assurances, the U.S. explicitly says that it still reserves the right to place Julian Assange under special administrative measures if he does something that would warrant such a regime, whatever that might be. The U.S. also said that it won't place Assange in ADX Florence, which is the super maximum prison in Colorado. It didn't say it won't place him in any supermax. It just said ADX Florence, and that's a problem because ADX Florence is the only super maximum prison at the federal level, but the United States has many other super maximum prisons. And it did not say that it won't place Assange in any of its super maximum prisons. It only mentioned ADX Florence. Again, this is why no one can trust the United States and their reassurances, because they don't mean anything. The United States also said that Assange will be able to serve a sentence in Australia. But why should Assange serve any sentence, whether in the U.S. or Australia or elsewhere? Assange is an innocent man. He's not been convicted of the crimes that they are accusing him of, and yet he still sits in Belmarsh prison in a maximum security jail. Why is that? Ultimately, the decision to place him under special administrative measures will be left up to the CIA director and the attorney general. And given the intelligence community's animosity and contempt for Assange, and the fact that the DOJ is going after him so viciously from administration to administration, it's absolutely guaranteed that he will be placed under SAMs. There is no doubt about this, and the U.S. openly advocated this possibility in court, as I've seen myself. Now, these developments, they come at a strange time, however. Barely a week before the United States was granted limited permission to appeal, a bombshell revelation appeared in an Icelandic newspaper named Stundin. One of the key witnesses in the prosecution against Assange admitted that he had lied and fabricated his entire witness statement against the WikiLeaks founder. Sigurdur Thordarson, also known as Siggy the Hacker, is referred to in the U.S. indictment as Teenager. Now, this superseding indictment was unsealed in June 2020, just before the extradition hearing was set to proceed at the Old Bailey in London. The new indictment contained no new charges. Instead, it only had conduct, alleged conduct, which refers to narrative taken from testimonies like Siggy the Hacker's or from Sabu, who's another hacker turned FBI informant. This alleged conduct had only one purpose, which was to paint Assange as a hacker and a cyber criminal rather than a journalist. And although there were no new charges, this alleged conduct would be helpful for the prosecution in securing a conviction and or stronger sentencing. In his witness statement to the court, Thordarson exaggerated his relationship with Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. He falsely claimed that Assange had instructed him to commit a number of crimes together, such as stealing encrypted banking files and recording the phone call conversations of members of parliament in Iceland, referred to in the indictment as NATO Country One. Quote, Thordarson now admits to Sundin that Assange never asked him to hack or access phone recordings of MPs. His new claim is that he had in fact received some files from a third party who claimed to have recorded MPs and had offered to share them with Assange without having any idea what they actually contained. He claims he never checked the contents of the files or even if they contained audio recordings, as his third-party source suggested. He further admits the claim that Assange had instructed or asked him to access computers in order to find any such recordings is false. Now, during his time with WikiLeaks, Thordarson also worked to hurt the organization. He impersonated Julian Assange and embezzled $50,000 from online sales while committing various other crimes that were unbeknownst to Assange and WikiLeaks. Quote, Thordarson also admits that he stole documents from WikiLeaks staff by copying their hard drives. Among those were documents from Renata Avila, a lawyer who worked for the organization, and Mr. Assange. Now, Thordarson also went on to contact the U.S. Embassy in Iceland and volunteer to become an informant against Assange. Within 48 hours, a private jet full of U.S. government agents touched down in Iceland in order to begin working with him. It's incredible, absolutely incredible, then, that barely a week after this explosive revelation, the UK still decides to grant the US limited permission to appeal. I mean, the entire indictment is based on lies. And unfortunately, Judge Barrett's ruling was formulated based on those lies. Usually, one would expect this case to be thrown out after such a bombshell revelation. And yet, that has not happened. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Joined by investigative journalist Stefania Morizzi. She contributes to a major Italian daily, Il Fatto Quotidiano, and has previously written extensively for some of the best newspapers in Italy, such as Espresso and Repubblica. She's renowned the world over for her amazing work as a media partner with WikiLeaks, and has also worked previously with Glenn Greenwald on the NSA leaks from Edward Snowden. She's a good friend, and it's my pleasure to welcome her. Thanks for coming on, Stefania. It's really great to have you.
Oh, thanks to you, Richard. Thanks so much.
So, Stefania, I'd like to start out with the fact that just recently Julian Assange turned 50 years old while he's locked up inside Belmarsh Prison in London. And you've known him a long time. You know, very tragically, he spent his entire 40s being persecuted by various governments for his journalism, hasn't he?
Well, first of all, I can remember that I was one of the journalists invited to his 40th birthday party, and I couldn't attend it. I couldn't be there because I was under pressure working on my book. And I mean, it was so sad. Now I realize how sad it is, because he has always been under confinement, under house arrest. His 40th birthday party was at Ellingham Hall. He was under house arrest. And then inside the embassy, 7 years, 6 years and 8 months without an hour outdoors. And then now in maximum security prison, the so-called British Guantanamo. And you know, he has never known freedom again.
We recently had a bombshell revelation in the Icelandic newspaper in Stundin that one of the key witnesses who's testifying against Julian for the U.S. prosecution, Sigurdur Thordarson, who's also known as Siggy the Hacker, he fabricated his testimony. I mean, this is an incredible development. So you would think that the entire case would collapse based on this alone, never mind all the other cases of foul play that we've seen. Why is it, do you think, that this has gone largely unreported and unconsidered by the courts and the judiciary?
Well, I think at the end of the day, it will be a serious problem for the U.S. authorities. I mean, they are relying on a person who is highly problematic, to say the least, you know? Apparently, I mean, I have never met Siggy, though I have worked for 10 years, for over a decade on the WikiLeaks documentation and the case. I have never met Siggy. However, I have always heard that he was volunteering and with doing minor tasks, and it was highly problematic. And according to the many press reports, he had serious problems. He tried to steal money from WikiLeaks. He was an FBI informant, and even the Icelandic authorities were absolutely against collaborating with the FBI. This meant that they realized there was something really bad about this situation. I never heard, you know, it's quite unique that police national authorities refuse to cooperate with the FBI. Usually, you know, it is considered prestigious. It is kind of prestigious for police authorities to cooperate with the FBI. So if they refuse to cooperate, even when public, this means that probably they smell something really bad. So I believe this case will be highly problematic for the U.S. So I expect some interesting development.
Yeah, I mean, it is astonishing, right? Because just barely a week after this bombshell revelation, the UK granted the US limited permission to appeal Judge Bretzer's decision not to extradite. Why do you think it is that the UK gave them limited permission? And it was just on three grounds, right? So 3 out of 5. Why is that?
As far as I can understand, the UK did not grant permission to appeal to the US, but they did not grant the appeal on the basis of his health conditions. So it seems to me that they are trying to keep these health conditions as, kind of as the unique factor on which they rely to deny extradition, which is highly problematic. Because, you know, they should deny they should deny extradition on the basis of his work, not just on his health conditions. This is the real scandal about this case. Had we had serious adversarial journalism, there would be a fuss, there would be a public scandal about this case. Even in the US, there is, apart from the independent media, apart from the independent reporters, and apart from Glenn Greenwald, there is basically no coverage. I believe that the public opinion understand very little about this case because there is no coverage, you know?
And, you know, Stefani, speaking of the United States, they said allegedly that they won't put Julian under special administrative measures or SAMs, but they reserve the right to do so, and they're also supposedly offering him an opportunity to serve a sentence in Australia. I mean, why should he serve any sentence in the first place? What do you make of these so-called assurances from the U.S.?
This case is a travesty and travesty of justice, and this case is a massive scandal, and these diplomatic assurances should never have been trusted, as Amnesty International immediately acknowledged. They are absolutely unreliable. They say, well, we will not put you in a maximum security prison in the most extreme most extreme U.S. prison, ABX Florence, but if you do something we don't like, we will reserve the right to do it. You know, how can you accept anything like that, you know? And he should never have it go to the U.S. No chance he goes to the U.S. and he comes out, you know. He should never have it go there.
Truly, I mean, I wholeheartedly share your sentiment, Stefani. And just as a last question, I was wondering if you maybe heard about the recent developments regarding the Official Secrets Act in the UK. You know, the British government is now saying it wants to punish journalists who leak damaging information for up to 14 years. I don't know, did you hear about that perhaps? Because, you know, to me it looks like they're just kind of trying to make sure they copy the United States and keep up with, you know, the same brand of authoritarianism.
Don't underestimate what they are doing. They have a serious strategy, a very serious strategy. And the confirmation comes from my Freedom of Information litigation on Christine Raftson, Joseph Farrell, and Sarah Harrison. They are using national security, and they are denying me this documentation about them. And this documentation is the correspondence between Scotland Yard, the so-called Metropolitan Police, Scotland Yard, and the U.S. Department of Justice. And they claim we cannot reveal this documentation because it would compromise the national security and our ability to fight terrorism. Can you believe they are applying anti-terror laws to journalists? And they admitted, you know, the most serious thing is that Scotland Yard didn't deny they are journalists. They acknowledge they are journalists. So they have a plan here, and the plan here is to criminalize any kind of serious, aggressive, and fearless journalism exposing state criminality at the highest level, and they want to punish it as they publish spies. I think it's extremely important journalism, and it has been copied by many, and none of them are in prison, none of them are being put in prison, or so it's, you know, it's crucial. We have to win this case, Richard. We have absolutely to win this case.
In the background, while these developments in Assange's case have been taking place, the British government has continued to clamp down on press freedoms through various means. In a document titled Legislation to Counter State Threats, which was published in May 2021, the Home Office proposed a series of reforms to the Official Secrets Act. Now, these proposed reforms seek harsher sentencing for whistleblowers and journalists who publish classified documents. Under Priti Patel's Home Office proposal, the government argues that unauthorized disclosures are just as bad, if not worse, than espionage. It says, quote, we do not consider that there is necessarily a distinction in severity between espionage and the most serious unauthorized disclosures, unquote. So the British government is essentially saying that since journalists and publishers can reach a wider audience and reach more people, an unauthorized disclosure on their part is worse than an enemy's spy stealing documents, because that would only benefit one state actor and cause less damage somehow. This is simply unbelievable. Not only that, but the British government has still failed to include an adequate public interest defense and wishes to increase the maximum sentence of 2 years for journalists and whistleblowers who publish things the government doesn't like. This document is effectively and explicitly criminalizing investigative journalism and equating it with espionage. The recent revelation in the Assange case that a key witness lied in their testimony is hardly surprising at all, because the entire legal case is filled with illegalities and wrongdoing on the behalf of various governments, and one of those governments is the British government. According to former employees of UC Global, they admit that the firm was contracted by US intelligence to spy on Assange in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. This included listening in on Assange's conversations with his lawyers, which violates his right to a fair trial and right to due process under virtually every jurisdiction, whether EU or US or British common law. There was even a plan to kidnap and poison him, which was discussed. I mean, the fact that the judge accepted all the political charges against Assange, which are not only untrue, but also criminalizes journalism, is extremely disheartening. At the end of the day, she did block his extradition, but she also blocked his bail request. It took six months, since the ruling, just to get permission for the U.S. to appeal, meaning that Assange could spend years in jail just getting through this dragged-out legal process, right? Languishing in Belmarsh prison, in a maximum security prison, his mental and physical health indicate. And in her ruling, Judge Bretzer, she went on through each charge under U.S. law and equated it to British common law under the Official Secrets Act in order to satisfy the criteria for an extradition. And this expansion of the legal case into British law is worrying enough on its own. However, the new prospects and proposals by the British government go even further, and they explicitly criminalize standard journalistic activities and whistleblowers for exposing government crimes and government wrongdoing. If the big media outlets in the UK were honest, they would be outraged about what's happening to Assange or these proposed reforms to the Official Secrets Act. Instead, what do? They quietly stay away from these issues and barely report on them in order to protect the government from criticism and scrutiny, because they are dishonest actors and they work on behalf of the British state. We saw in previous months how the United Kingdom under Boris Johnson's government, with no opposition from Keir Starmer's Labour, passed several authoritarian laws. This included the Covert Human Intelligence Sources, or CHIS Act, allowing undercover agents in the UK to commit criminal acts in the name of Britain's national and economic security. We also saw the passage of the Overseas Operations Bill, giving British troops immunity from war crimes prosecutions in violation of international law. The British government then introduced the Police Court Sentencing and Crimes Bill, giving police sweeping powers to shut down protests, in addition to sentencing of up to 10 years for people who deface a statue. This suggestion by the government to equate journalists now with spies and punish them under the Official Secrets Act for doing their jobs by informing the public, this is merely an extension of these same draconian, archaic laws. It's yet another step away from democracy and towards authoritarianism. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
In the limelight.
Obama, Trump, and Biden administrations have all prosecuted whistleblowers for revealing evidence of U.S. war crimes. In addition to Hale, those courageous folks include Chelsea Manning, Julian Assange, and John Kerouac, who revealed that CIA officials used waterboarding, which constitutes the war crime of torture. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Marjorie Kahn Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Drone Whistleblower Gets 45 Months in Prison for Revealing Ongoing U.S. War Crimes. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. July 27th, a federal district court judge in Alexandria, Virginia, sentenced former U.S. Air Force intelligence analyst Daniel Hale to 45 months in prison for revealing evidence of U.S. war crimes. In 2015, Hale, whose job involved identifying targets for drone strikes, provided journalist Jeremy Schill with secret military documents and slides that exposed shocking details about the U.S. drone program. Hale's revelations became the basis of the drone papers, which was published on October 15, 2015 by The Intercept. Although the government admitted it had no evidence that direct harm resulted from Hale's revelations, in 2019, the Trump administration charged Hale with four counts of violating the Espionage Act and one count of theft of government property. Facing up to 50 years in prison, Hale pled guilty to one count that carries a maximum sentence of 10 years. The leaked documents disclosed the kill chain the Obama administration used to determine whom to target. Countless civilians were killed using signals intelligence in undeclared war zones. Targeting decisions were made by